I was brought into this current discussion thread regarding the vaccine technology and safety because of my role in initial discovery and development of the core technology platform. I build teams to solve complicated problems for the government in the area of biodefense and vaccines and medical countermeasures. Right. I've been through so many of these outbreaks. Dr. Fauci just says stuff. He says whatever he feels like saying, and it's not necessarily fact-based, it's just based on his opinion. And we now know that it's often based on what he thinks is best, rather than being grounded in data. There's no question that we've been told a series of things that just aren't consistent with the data. And we can call them misrepresentations or we can call them flat-out lies. They continue to happen on almost a daily basis. Yeah. To the extent that you deploy vaccine, you should deploy vaccine into those extremely high-risk individuals. You should not deploy it into the general population.
So why are they doing it?
And I what's don't your sense? Know. Yeah. It's paradoxical. Personally, I think what we're seeing is rampant war profiteering. Hi, I'm Robert Malone. I'm a physician and scientist licensed to practice in the state of Maryland. I've been active in vaccine development for about 30 years. My time spans multiple pandemic and epidemic outbreaks, fortunately or unfortunately. And I've become kind of a specialist in both outbreaks and in biodefense. My clients range from small startup companies through very large pharmaceutical companies. I also do commercial intelligence work and expert witness work. Through all of this, I've worked very closely, continue to work closely with the Department of Defense. When people ask me generally, what do I do for a living? The quick answer is I build teams to solve complicated problems for the government in the area of biodefense and vaccines and medical countermeasures. Examples was the work that we did with repurposing drugs for Zika, working closely with USAMRIID in Frederick and Fort Detrick. And before that, the work that I did basically spearheading the, on behalf of DOD and close association, the initial development and writing all the grants and contracts, etc., that enabled the public health agency Canada vaccine for Ebola that was owned by NewLink to move forward under DOD funding. I brought in a company called Merck that bought that vaccine from NewLink, and that's now the licensed Ebola vaccine. So I was very involved in that project, bringing Merck on board, getting it moved forward, getting the money together. And I was the one that brought in the Norwegian government because of my contacts there. That eventually led to CEPI. So I have deep knowledge and expertise of the whole biodefense enterprise on the HHS and on the DOD side. I'm often asked to chair study sections for large contract bids for NIAID. And in the current outbreak, I received a call from a colleague that I've published with for a number of years before, named Michael Callahan, who is an intelligence person who was located in Wuhan in the fourth quarter of 2019. And he called me on January 4th and told me that I better get my team spun up because this new virus looked like it was going to be a problem. I was brought into this current discussion thread regarding the vaccine technology and safety because of my role in initial discovery and development of the core technology platform and my ability to my knowledge of the government and the technology and the state of development. I have a colleague, for instance, that I had mentored back in the Ebola days that was project manager. He's now a full colonel, project manager for the Operation Warp Speed Moderna project. That I've spoken with about that project. I have good friends at the FDA that we've been talking about all these things for over a year now. And that kind of set things up for people seeking my opinion about the current situation.
What is mRNA and what is a mRNA vaccine? And can it properly be called a vaccine? Is it perhaps better called a gene therapy?
So the metaphor I like to use when I'm trying to explain this to those that haven't been through molecular biology is the central dogma of biology is that DNA makes RNA, RNA makes protein. That's a bit of an oversimplification because there's different kinds of RNAs. There's RNAs that guide the manufacturing of protein, and there are RNAs that are structural, for example, that are incorporated into ribosomes, okay? So the RNA that's used to guide the production of proteins is called message. It's a message that goes from the DNA to the protein manufacturing equipment that's in the cytoplasm. And so that's why it's called messenger RNA. To think about this conceptually, it may help. If most of us have laptops or are familiar with computers, if you think about the DNA residing in the nucleus, that's akin to your hard drive. The programs that are on your hard drive are akin to genes and regulatory sequences. And I'm going to reach back for an old computer metaphor. mRNA is kind of like a punch card or a ticker tape that's produced from the DNA that's in the nucleus. And I use the metaphor of a punch card because it's a physical molecule that has a string of coded information. It's actually a 4-base code instead of a 2-base code with a computer with binary code. And it moves like a punch card in a stack of punch cards. It gets moved from the core program, which is your DNA in your nucleus, out and it transmits that information as a physical molecule to something that functions like a little tiny biorobot. If you think about a robot that manufactures cars or whatever, or carves wood, that's akin to a ribosome. But what those little tiny cellular robots do is they make proteins. And so the RNA goes from the DNA messenger RNA, to the ribosomes, these little tiny biorobots, where they manufacture protein. In the case of the vaccines, the protein they're manufacturing is spike, and they are actually, this process causes your cells to become little manufacturing factories for the actual final vaccine product, which is the protein spike. Does that make sense?
That does. Now, what guarantee do we have that the message that is being conveyed doesn't keep getting conveyed, that the cells don't produce spike ad infinitum?
So that's a good question, and it's one of the key differences between adenoviral vectors and mRNA-based vaccines. So the logic that I came up with years ago was that the benefit of potentially using RNA as a drug for any application is that unlike the traditional gene therapy approaches where you would put the gene into the cell, such as with a retrovirus, it actually integrated to the chromosome, and hopefully it would be expressed for the lifetime of the patient. That was the original concept. The idea behind RNA as a drug and RNA vaccines is that RNA is a fairly labile polynucleotide, so it's a long string of negatively charged molecules, and they get chewed up very rapidly by enzymes. You can think of the metaphor of Pac-Man. When they're in the cytoplasm, they actually have something akin to a fuse at one end that gradually burns. That's the poly-A tail. And once that gets chewed off, then the rest of the RNA gets rapidly degraded. So the idea is that if you use RNA-based approaches, you can dose the patient, and if there's an adverse event, a problem, then you can, the RNA will be degraded and you just don't redose the patient. Whereas with standard gene therapy, if there's a problem, you're kind of stuck because you have that DNA integrated into the cells. Adenoviral vectors are DNA viruses that have been engineered so that you can place your genetic sequence, your open reading frame, coding for a protein, into those cold viruses, and they will infect your cells. That DNA will go into the nucleus. It generally doesn't integrate, but it stays there a long time. So with the adenoviral vectors, they were designed for long-term expression of high levels of protein. That was the whole idea behind them. With the RNA, transient expression, and hopefully rapid degradation, so you just get a pulse of protein expressed. Now, whether or not that's actually the case in the human with these formulations, unfortunately, was not really well characterized before they were widely rolled out in humans.
Now, the trials, such as they were run by the companies themselves, right? Moderna.
I would back off on that a little bit. It's an interesting situation. You know that BioNTech was funded by the German government and Moderna was funded by DARPA. So that's an American investment. The construction and initial testing of the mRNA construct was done by Vaccine Research Center, which is a branch of NIAID. The final formulation process development was done by a company called Ginkgo up in Boston area. So Moderna actually didn't do much in terms of what was finally produced. They outsourced a lot of that stuff. And yes, a lot of the money came through Operation Warp Speed. A lot of the management of that process and management of the decisions about the concentration that of how much would be administered, etc., were all handled by Operation Warp Speed personnel, which was largely government.
What I was driving at in terms of who's running the trials, etc., is there any independent force or anyone you trust, or have you yourself looked at the vaccines in any, you know, at the molecular level?
No.
And you don't know of anyone who has?
No. I know of people who claim to look at the final drug product after it's been sitting out on the bench and have made claims about graphene oxide and things like that. The problem I have with that is these lipid formulations are aggregate at room temperature readily. And I can't, from the EMs that I've seen, I can't distinguish, you know, what that material is. It is reasonably likely to be lipid polynucleotide aggregates, macroaggregates, I can't say about the testing for graphene oxide. It's not listed as an ingredient. If it is present, it's an adulterant. My opinion is that just because of the darn rumors, the FDA ought to do an audit and assess, one of those lots, sample some lots, and send them out to have them analyzed. There are certainly, I'm aware of clauses in the Pfizer contract that make it so that third parties are not allowed to analyze the final drug product.
So right now, all we have is the respective company's word for what's in the shots.
Well, we also have the Japanese common technical document that Dr. Bridle obtained. It's in Japanese, has some key studies revealed there. I haven't seen the translated version to know what other information is in there. Presumably, the FDA has a full dossier. And I've been told, I spoke to Peter Marks about this after the Bridle document came to light. So I sought him out and we had a brief chat over Zoom. With another FDA personnel present, external affairs person. And he assured me that the Pfizer dossier that they're currently reviewing is different and much more substantial.
Well, the Pfizer dossier that the Japanese cause to be created. It has to do with distribution, right? I mean,
that's the part that has gotten so much attention. But no, a common technical document or IND application is a comprehensive summary that's of everything that's known about the product.
Okay, and you're saying, but did the Japanese conduct that review, or did Pfizer conduct that review?
The way it works in regulatory affairs is the sponsor submits the dossier and the regulatory agency reviews the dossier.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
That does. And that brings me to my next question, which is how tightly integrated are regulatory agencies, politicians at the legislative level, at the executive level, at the defense level, and these massive firms? I mean, it seems to me, you've mentioned in prior interviews, and you know, we've done interviews where it's very clear there's a revolving door at the very least, and that there's regulatory capture. There is, you know, really, it's like where one starts and the other begins is very unclear.
The whole system is horizontally integrated, and there's no question that there is ample evidence of significant regulatory capture and revolving door at the FDA. Just to make an example, the former head of the vaccine research branch, Norm Baylor, retired and immediately became head of the biologics consulting group, and he now consults for all the major vaccine companies.
The FDA as a public health agency, how does your work support that?
My work supports that in the sense that we're responsible for facilitating the availability of safe and effective vaccines. We're involved in evaluating those products, basically reviewing the dossiers from manufacturers, but we also are involved in testing and doing research on a variety of different products.
Are we at that point where we need a booster? And so there are, I think that being prepared to make boosters is a good thing. We don't have the evidence that it's time for a booster. The other thing about boosters is we need to determine what type of booster are we going to use.
There was a pretty high-level CDC person who did go over to become VP of vaccines over at Merck.
Yeah, her name was Julie Gerberding, and she was head of this of she was head of the CDC, and she was actually the one that I contacted to set up the Merck deal for the Ebola vaccine.
So this is a very tight-knit community, and everyone
it's a
knows.
It's a small world. In terms of my colleagues and talking about what the government responses were, in general, I can only speak for myself. I mean, we had many casual conversations. We were kind of amazed at how slow and kludgy and inefficient and I don't know how to characterize it. Just goofy, the government response was, nonsensical about a whole lot of things through that whole period.
Right.
I've been through so many of these outbreaks. Dr. Fauci just says stuff. Hmm. He says whatever he feels like saying, and it's not necessarily fact-based, it's just based on his opinion, and we now know that it's often based on what he thinks is best rather than being grounded in data. So for us, often the kind of the cognitive dissonance is, you know, being obsessively focused on the data and hearing these statements coming out from leadership that are inconsistent with the data and our understanding at that time. There were ample literature from SARS-1 that mask use was helpful. Mask use was widespread in China and de rigueur. And so based on the literature from SARS-1, the literature that we pulled out in our initial evaluation, and the common practice of N95 use in the People's Republic, it was our opinion that it was one activity that somebody can do to help protect them from fomites and larger airborne particles that might be coming at them from the general environment. Masks are to protect you. They're not generally to protect the other person.
Uh-huh. Well, that's interesting and a flip of what the government says. But The fomites you're talking about, are you talking about large phlegm particles that would only be expressed by someone symptomatic?
Symptomatic or not, a lot of what's transmitted is, at least we believed at the time, was likely. So using, for instance, Ebola as an example, Ebola is not aerosol transmitted, and yet people can get infected when someone coughs, for instance, where they're being extubated. And that's what took down a number of physicians in Africa. So there's a spectrum from really tiny particles that you can't do much about.
Right.
To particles trapped in mucus and, sure, and other...
But what's your opinion now? Should healthy people, asymptomatic people, people who may not have, you know, may have been asymptomatic because they literally didn't have any SARS-CoV-2 present in their system, should they have all been wearing masks walking down the street?
There's no evidence that walking down the street requires, there's any benefit associated with mask use. Mask is to protect you. It's this thesis that it's to protect the general population from you is not consistent with this type of masking. If you were going to use a full respirator with a tight seal, then yes. But even then, you don't use a respirator with a tight seal to prevent you shedding particles that someone else might encounter. Use it to keep you from breathing in particles that somebody else might be shedding or might be coming out of the dust or whatever. Okay, so it's the whole logic. There's a bunch of, there's no question that we've been told a series of things that just aren't consistent with the data. And we can call them misrepresentations or we can call them flat out lies. They continue to happen on almost a daily basis. And it's justified by that apparently public health officials feel that it's acceptable to make these misrepresentations for what they believe to be the public good. I talk about this in a number of my podcasts and writing as the noble lie. And there has, you know, there is, for instance, an article in the Federal Register from, believe it or not, 1984, in which there's a clear statement. In that context, they're speaking about polio vaccines, that any information which would cause vaccine hesitancy, whether true or not, about a virus should be suppressed and not made available to the general public because it would lead to vaccine hesitancy. So this is a, you know, a 20th century concept that it's okay to lie to the general population for their own good. You know, this is a concept that goes back to Plato. It's usually only applied in politics. I think that is way outdated and totally inappropriate and inconsistent with the common rule and the requirements for clinical research and full disclosure, etc. But clearly, as documented by the FOIA'd emails from Dr. Fauci, leadership at HHS feels that it's totally acceptable to lie to the public for what they believe is the common good as they define it.
What's the most egregious noble lie that you've heard come out of NIH or out of any of these, well, out of Fauci?
They just continue. I don't know how to rank them. The statements that the vaccines are perfectly safe and perfectly effective is right at the top of my list.
Have you taken a vaccine?
I have. I've had Moderna times two. I took them because this is always asked, why did you take the vaccine? This is a few months ago. As you recall, I mentioned that I got COVID in late February of 2020. I developed long COVID. I still have it. There was a rumor circulating in the long hauler world that vaccines could help with this syndrome. I had watched long enough and felt that the risk of antibody-dependent enhancement wasn't really manifesting, so that worry was no longer a focus for me at the time. It is more of one now. We needed to travel. So I took Moderna times two, had adverse events on both. After the second one, I developed grade 3 hypertension, increased cough, narcolepsy, and restless leg syndrome. So I've kind of been through the ringer all the way through, and recently took a round of 3 days of ivermectin and had an amazing response, regained stamina, was able to hike, slept through the night, and woke up without coughing.
Is that possibly because the vaccine creates the same spike that the disease does, and therefore, or allegedly, and therefore, I mean,
My working hypothesis. I've talked about this multiple times before. There's a clear overlap between the post-vaccination syndrome, I like to call it, long COVID, and the disease itself. And many of those symptoms occur in the post-vaccination syndrome, both with the adenoviral vectors and with the mRNA. So you just, as a scientist, you got to say, what's the thing in common between all of these sources of these characteristics? And the answer is spike. I don't know any other way to, I don't have another hypothesis that accounts for that.
Recently, there was a doctor or scientist who came out to say that, you know, he had been working on the development of the spike, you know, the vaccine, and he said, you know, we've made a terrible mistake, you know, it doesn't just aggregate at the injection site, it spreads everywhere. I mean, I'm just wondering, what could the thinking have been to create that thing which is dangerous about coronavirus?
That's very simple. There was prior work with SARS-1 as well as with MERS that focused on spike as an antigen. And in fact, the specific mutations incorporated into all of these vaccines spike antigens that lock spike into an open conformation was previously piloted. I can pull up the paper and show it to you. This was a case of in the thick of it. People that were on, you know, hyperadrenaline, really pumped up, trying to do something as quick as possible, chose the easiest pathway to produce what they thought would be an effective vaccine. Mm. And they didn't really question themselves. Anytime you make decisions like that, it's really good idea to have a few skeptics on the team that are saying, yeah, but what if? Which is kind of one of the things I do. For some reason, Tony didn't call me up to participate in the team. Clearly, the VRC team and the BioNTech team and the J&J team all were thinking very much alike, because they looked at the literature, they picked the thing that was they believed to be most likely to be successful. In, you know, the in the entrepreneurial world, we call this low-hanging fruit. And that's what they picked and used. And they didn't really think hard about what could go wrong. I had been very aware that ADE, or antibody-dependent enhancement, had compromised all prior coronavirus vaccine development efforts, except for a couple veterinary vaccines where they were able to overcome it. But even in those cases, it was a major problem. And ADE was one of the reasons why I believed at the outset that building a safe and effective coronavirus vaccine for SARS-CoV-2 was going to take a long time. And it really was not the appropriate focus for developmental efforts, certainly not for my team. What is antibody-dependent enhancement? So it's one of a spectrum of, it's the easiest one to explain, of a spectrum of effects that can occur with vaccines in which the vaccination actually makes the disease worse, or the infection, the viral replication, more efficient. And in the case of antibody-dependent enhancement, the three words each have meaning. They contribute to understanding it. Antibodies can, if they aren't fully inactivating of a virus at a given concentration, they can bind the virus and facilitate its entry and infection into cells that it might not otherwise infect. And it manifests, and so you can get much higher levels of replication and in some cases increased pathology because of this effect. The most notable example is what happened in the 60s with respiratory syncytial virus, a virus which kills young infants with fairly high frequency. and it was slated as being the next pediatric vaccine to be developed after the classical MMR series. And it was found that as they deployed this in the initial clinical trials, that the children and infants that received the vaccine actually died at a much higher frequency than their negative controls that had not received the vaccine. So antibody-dependent enhancement is the vaccinologist's worst nightmare, that the product that you work so hard to create actually causes worse disease. Antibody-dependent enhancement usually shows up in the waning phase of a vaccine response, when the titers taper off. And the kind of the, sorry, overused perfect storm that's happened is we found out that the Pfizer vaccine isn't very durable. It doesn't protect for more than about 6 or 7 months. Typically what happens is you educate B and T cell populations through the lymph node with the antigen that's produced, and those differentiate to effector cells and to memory cells. And those memory cells replenish the effector cell population, but the effector cells live for a certain period of time and produce antibodies, and then those antibodies themselves have half-lives that they circulate for. So the net sum is you get a dampened curve with a long tail. So it's not a normal distribution like you would see, you know, for grades or something like that, but rather a steep slope at the front end when the vaccine is first administered, and then a long tapering. And the question is the slope on that taper and where the intersection is on that slope for protection. So what we learned was that taper is actually remarkably sharp in the case of the Pfizer vaccine, and that after about 6 months, that vaccine is no longer providing what is considered empirically to be protection.
How do we know that it provided any protection at all to begin with?
We have the flawed clinical studies. I acknowledge that they're far from perfect, and some might say designed to not be able to detect certain types of adverse events. Specifically, one thing they were not designed to detect is antibody-dependent enhancement. And that's recognized by the FDA, because in the FDA authorization letter for emergency use authorization, they specifically say that the data are not sufficient to rule out antibody-dependent enhancement. It remains a significant risk, and suggested to the vaccine companies that they should do follow-on clinical studies to detect the presence or absence of antibody-dependent enhancement. But they didn't insist that the vaccine companies do that. And the vaccine companies, as near as I can tell from looking at clinicaltrials.gov and the literature, the vaccine companies decided to take a pass and not investigate whether or not ADE would occur.
And what about just in terms of efficacy? I mean, how do we know? I mean, there's relative risk reduction and absolute risk reduction.
Yeah, this whole discussion. So, you know, what is it? Is it really a 90%+ improvement over controls, or is it a 1 or 2% improvement over controls in terms of the protection for disease and death afforded? There's some evidence, there's some what appears to be kind of convenient massaging of data, manipulating of data, and selection of reporting measures. But for sure we can say that there is now a reasonable clinical evidence that there is protection from disease and death. The protection from infection, replication, and spread was touted as being quite high, but the Israeli data in particular has demonstrated that protection from infection, replication, and transmission in vaccinated subjects may be only 60%. What is clear from the data is that in this period of time, particularly in the Israeli data, also in the UK data, and perhaps there's signs of it, for instance, in a Massachusetts study, that number one, vaccinated people are being infected at high frequency. The statement that all the ones in the hospital are unvaccinated is an untruth, would be the kindest way I could put that. The Israeli data and the British data make it very clear that the incidence of infection and disease is quite high in the vaccinated population. This is originally justified and kind of washed as, well, there's many more people that are vaccinated than unvaccinated. And so the fact that we're seeing many more vaccinated persons in the hospital than unvaccinated, well, that was just a artifact of the fraction of the population that was vaccinated. That seems to be becoming untenable increasingly. What we do know is the distribution of virus levels, load, whether it's measured by PCR cycles or some measure that correlates more directly to titer, in the vaccinated is at least as high, those vaccinated that have breakthrough infections that become infected, is at least as high as in the unvaccinated. And to my eye, it looks like there's suggestions that there may be a subset of patients that have been vaccinated and infected that have even higher levels of viral replication than are present in the unvaccinated population. That, if that was told true, that would be the smoking gun demonstrating antibody-dependent enhancement. There's more and more signs that something like that may be occurring. There's some oddities in the UK data where there's an odd flip where the vaccinated have lower incidence of hospitalization but higher death compared to the unvaccinated. It's small numbers, but it's persistent. So there are, I like to call it ghosts in the data, that are suggesting that we are having antibody-dependent enhancement to some extent. And the concern is, are we going to see more of that as time goes by? You have to keep in mind, for instance, in the Israeli data, that they were all vaccinated as a pulse, basically, as a bolus over a fairly short period of time compared to, say, the U.S. And so that moves through time, that bolus of vaccinated, and they will be moving through this six-month window kind of in synchrony. And so if AD is happening during that waning phase, you're going to see that suddenly coming up as a wave of more and more patients that have been previously vaccinated.
Well, how would we factor in the Delta variant and the booster shot?
So that now complicates the ability to disambiguate those data. What we mostly have right now is the Delta variant. I've asked some Israeli scientists that are able to, that are collecting data outside of the official databases, because the official databases are all owned and controlled by Pfizer. And so in Israel, there's a group that is independently gathering data from hospitals about this. And I've asked them to parse that data into titers in patients that were vaccinated less than 6 months ago versus those that were vaccinated more than 6 months ago. And we'll see if we see a split in the viral load in those populations. So I'm looking forward to getting that data, hopefully in the next couple of weeks.
How can you even get a signal of efficacy with a disease that basically doesn't cause hospitalization and death in most people?
It's a fair question. The figures that I object a little bit to how you're thinking about this. What I think I sense is you're thinking, you're falling into the same logic trap that the government does and the WHO is, okay? Maybe because you're allowing them to frame the question. The morbidity and mortality in 70 to 80-year-olds is quite high. The morbidity and mortality in as a sole cause in infants through 18 is almost completely non-existent. All of those that have died up to the age of 18 since the beginning of the outbreak have all had significant comorbidities. In other words, they had other types of disease that was quite significant. In addition, there's tons of reports of, let's say, over-categorization of death as attributable to COVID. And so the vector sum of all of that is that all the data are basically junk. At the beginning of the outbreak, those of us that were chattering about this on LinkedIn, et cetera, and professional networks were derisive about the quality of the data from the People's Republic of China. and how that data was being manipulated. And in retrospect, I gotta say, that data was pretty clean compared to what we're dealing with now. So it's a valid point, but my objection is, I really strongly recommend that you and your viewers think about SARS-CoV-2, number one, infection as separate from COVID disease, okay? SARS-CoV-2 infection is necessary but not sufficient. COVID disease is your body's inflammatory response to getting infected by SARS-CoV-2. Now, a whole nother ball of wax is what exactly, that you haven't asked me yet, is what exactly is COVID? It's a cluster of symptoms, but a lot of them are pretty nonspecific, and a lot of them overlap with influenza. So that brings up the whole thread once you add in the cross-reactivity and lack of specificity of the CDC PCR test between influenza and SARS-CoV-2. How much misclassification did we have? You know, is the inexplicable sudden collapse of influenza cases in North America partially a consequence of misclassification of influenza as SARS-CoV-2? I think there's a reasonable case to be made for that.
But and the CDC guidance that says assume COVID right from the
beginning. Right. So, but my core objection is that it's really not useful to spread the risk of this disease for death and disease across the whole population, across the whole age cohort. That's that. If you look at the curves, it's like this through the ages, and then it hits 70 or so, and it goes exponential.
Okay, doesn't that happen with aging anyway? 70 and 80 year olds are more inclined to die.
A large incidence of morbidity and mortality, and there's almost all of those deaths have multiple comorbidities. So how lethal is this is a valid question. And have we, there's the term iatrogenic, disease caused by drug treatment. You know, how much of the morbidity and mortality, especially in the early times, were the consequence of mismanagement? A good case can be made for the overuse of ventilators and positive pressure. In the case of Italy, a good case can be made of, let's say, overly enthusiastic intensive care unit physicians and pulmonologists and caregivers over-treating with hydroxychloroquine. Oh. Hydroxychloroquine, you know, there was a point in time, I remember clearly, I had the first copy of the PRC treatment protocols.
People's Republic of China is
correct. They were using chloroquine primarily. Then there was a switch to hydroxy because it's less toxic, better tolerated. But during the first wave of the Italian outbreak, when they were losing so many people, there was what to my eyes was an awful lot of if some is good, more is better. And people were grossly overdosed with hydroxy, and that probably contributed to deaths. A case can be made that remdesivir has been overused and inappropriately used. Then there's the case of clearly dexamethasone has been over-administered. The POTUS being treated with dexamethasone is entirely inconsistent with the recovery trial that defined the very narrow window within which one should administer dexamethasone. But it got in the minds of intensive care unit physicians that you treat COVID with dex. So they treat everybody that comes in the hospital with dex. That went on a long time. Dex absolutely hammers your immune system. So a lot of overtreatment, mistreatment, mismanagement, then we had all of the overlay of the politics of dexamethasone and Laura Ingraham and Donald Trump and
hydroxychloroquine.
And Chris Cuomo and all of that stuff.
Which in small doses, in many clinics throughout the world, seem to show with zinc and azithromycin perhaps really good effects. And they had to...
Particularly when administered early. So yeah. This is one of the other kind of... There's so many just in retrospect, major, major mistakes.
But let me ask you this, despite all this, and despite the deaths of despair that, you know, and the extra opioid deaths and all the stuff that's been going on, the overall mortality is not really that much out of line with other years. The population of Ireland, for instance, grew last year. I mean, is that your understanding? I mean, has overall mortality seen a huge spike, if I can use that term?
No, because it's not that lethal in most of the population. It's that lethal in a very small wedge of high-risk individuals and elderly. And so, those are the ones, that gets to the core of my argument. Yeah. To the extent that you deploy vaccine, you should deploy vaccine into those extremely high-risk individuals. You should not deploy it into the general population.
So why are they doing it?
And I don't know. Yeah. It's paradoxical. It is, you know, it's really hard to disambiguate, dissect apart commercial financial interests and incompetence and hubris and bullheadedness. I can't, you know, and then there is the whole spectrum of theories about the Great Reset and the World Economic Forum, and off we go into theory land, right? And I think that, again, I fault the government for its lack of transparency and clear communication. People with active minds facing a threat like this will seek explanations. And a lot of this thinking could have been clarified. All of our anxieties could have been alleviated if the government had just been more transparent and more honest about what was going on.
But it's not just our government, right? It's every government throughout the world.
This is the profound paradox. And the simplest explanation, Occam's razor, that I can come up with is the power of the pharmaceutical companies to co-opt media. And it's not just pharmaceutical companies. The Gates Foundation pays a very large fraction of the World Health Organization bills. And Bill is all in on vaccines. And so is Tony, and so is Francis Collins. And there is an enormous amount of money in some there. And then you've got the financial interests of Wellcome Trust and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and J&J and Pfizer and GSK, which I understand owns Pfizer stock in a significant way, and Merck. And these, you know, they're, to my eye, what it looks like to me, the best explanation I can come up with my level, I don't go to Davos. I don't hang around with those people. You know, I don't know what they think. I've run to people who do, and they come up with all crazy things that I've never heard of before. But what I know is that the pharmaceutical industry has gotten really, really good at co-opting governments. And they have enormous amounts of money. And this is, personally, I think what we're seeing is rampant war profiteering, and it has generated a huge amount of capital, and that capital is being turned sequentially on co-opting governments in succession through contract agreements. And contract agreements that restrict availability of information, ability to communicate, ability to sample and assess the shots themselves, to assess the clinical outcomes and disclose the clinical outcomes. And then there's this that I've experienced myself. I mean, I've been through this odd situation where I've been repeatedly attacked by these consortiums that can be tied back to the Trusted News Initiative. And so I've been motivated to try to understand what is coming at me, what's going on, me and a lot of other people. And what I've found is that at the top level in the board of directors, there's this amazing interdigitation between the pharmaceutical industry, big tech, and big media. And they sit on each other's boards. They're all connected. And then there are these profound connections back, you know, in terms of, I'm somebody who's worked the Hill. I'm not a registered lobbyist, but I've spent plenty of time talking to Congress folk. They all love Tony, because Tony basically controls a huge budget that he allocates by congressional district. He tracks by congressional district, okay? He has power over Congress, not the other way around. That's not the way it's supposed to be, but that's how he plays it. And he is tight in with Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The Foundation for NIH gets a lot of its money from Bill and Melinda Gates. So does the Foundation for the CDC. So we've built over time these loops of financial self-interest that have gotten stronger and stronger. My colleagues and I look, you asked what has been our reaction through all of this. One of our reactions has been, I've never seen anything like this in terms of the propaganda and information control and messaging control globally. Never seen anything like this in my life during an infectious outbreak.